Josh Sam is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Southern California. He is broadly interested in the governance of poverty and suffering, and this has led him into the sociologies of medicine, punishment, and labor. His work has appeared in the American Sociological Review, Sociological Methods and Research, Punishment and Society, Journal of Contemporary Ethnography, RSF, the Russell Sage Foundation Journal of the Social Sciences, and Teaching Sociology, among other outlets. On this episode, we discuss his book, Bandage, Sort and Hustle, Ambulance Crews on the Front Lines of Urban Suffering, published by the University of California Press. His book uses a labor-centric framework to understand the role of ambulance crews in American cities, which is what we speak about. Hi, Josh, and welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here today, and I'm very excited to know more about you and about the kind of work you've been doing. So to get us started, I'd just like to know a little bit about yourself, about your academic background, and about your interest in poverty, suffering, and medicine and like the ambulance as areas of research.
Sure. So yeah, I'm an assistant professor in the sociology department at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Before that, I was a graduate student in the sociology department at the University of California, Berkeley. I completed that program in 2018 and have been at USC ever since. Before my time at Berkeley, I was a master's student at Portland State University in Portland, Oregon. And then before that, I was a student in sociology as well at Gonzaga University, which is a private Jesuit school in Spokane, Washington. But I should say, I was a transfer student there, so I was only there for 2 years, and you know, most of my undergraduate experience was in community colleges at Spokane Community College in Spokane, Washington, and also at Clark Community College, or it's actually just called Clark College, but it's a community college in Vancouver, Washington, and it was there at Clark that I took my first sociology class, really loved sociology, really loved the content. Asked the instructor of the class, you know, how do you do what you do? What do I need to do to be in a position like you to say all these cool things and to talk about all these interesting ideas that were sort of at the time, you know, disrupting all of my worldviews? And she basically told me that you have to get a PhD in sociology. And so I started doing Googling and figured out that I was very far away from ever getting a PhD in sociology, that I would first have to transfer and get a bachelor's degree and then eventually get a master's degree. So yeah, you know, I like to think that I've been sort of doing sociology since 2006 when I was a community college student. And now I am in my fourth year on the tenure track at University of Southern California.
Well, thank you for the background. It's definitely interesting. And I think, you know, now to get a bit more specific into your publication, I think I'd just like to know a little bit about conventional narratives on the role of the ambulance in American cities, you know, especially looking at your book, Bandage, Sort and Hustle, on ambulance crews on the front lines of urban suffering.
Yeah, like I said, in terms of like, you know, what I love about sociology so much is it sort of disrupts our sort of, or at least the good sociology, in my opinion, does a lot to sort of disrupt our folk understandings of how various social processes or institutions work. And I like to think that my ambulance research does something similar to that, or at least approximates that. So, you know, when we think about what the ambulance is, I think, you know, everybody has a sort of working understanding of what ambulances do within the United States, particularly within large cities. I mean, we tend to think about it as an institution that treats and transports the critically ill and injured. And that's not an incorrect description. It's just incomplete in my view. And the ambulance plays a much broader role in governing an array of different human sufferings. Many of them are, you know, for critically ill and injured people, but a lot of them are for people who are not seen as critically ill and injured by this from the standpoint of ambulance crews. And so a lot of ambulance responses are for problems that are arguably mismatched with the skills of ambulance crews, the instruments that are at their disposal, and the various interventions that are even made possible in the ambulance. And so my research looks at how ambulance crews handle you know, a bulk of their cases being seemingly mismatched with the institution itself. And so I argue, and I take a sort of labor-centric approach to studying the ambulance, study it from the standpoint of workers. I don't ignore patients, I don't ignore other actors that are in the field, but I take a strong standpoint of kind of following the workers, studying the workers up close and their experiences in the labor process. And I argue that in studying the labor process, we can understand how the ambulance contributes to a governance of urban suffering in a variety of ways. And I argue that there's really three primary ways that ambulance crews contribute to the governance of those populations that bear the brunt of a multitude of different sufferings in the city. And so the title in many ways, you know, spoils the argument. I suggest that ambulance crews bandage suffering bodies by offering simple and often superficial solutions to deep and complicated structural problems in a capitalist and racist society, be that applying, you know, gauze to a gunshot wound or by connecting somebody to a hospital so that they can speak to a doctor about getting a prescription refill or something like that. Either way, it's a sort of band-aid solution to a very deep, complicated structural problem that's usually can easily be theorized and traced back to larger systems of capitalism and racism and so on. And they argue that ambulance crews help to sort suffering bodies and that they do this through their interactions with nurses at hospitals who they're often taking patients to, and also with police on the streets who they're often in interaction with during emergency scenes. And I argue that, you know, frontline workers, consistent with what we call in the street level bureaucracy literature, consistent with a lot of the arguments made in that literature, I argue that workers are significantly discretionary. They have some discretion in how they do their work, not total discretion. They're not free agent. They're limited by protocols and things like that, but they have some discretion. And some of that discretion plays a significant role, not only in terms of the types of interventions they're providing, the sort of bandaging of bodies that I talk about in the first part of the book, but also a sorting of bodies. And it's really in the discretionary interactions between the ambulance workers and police on the streets and ambulance workers and nurses at hospital that does a lot to determine how suffering populations who encounter the ambulance are sorted, whether they're taken to a hospital or not. If so, which hospital they're taken to and how are they triaged into the hospital? If they're not taken to the hospital, are they, you know, perhaps left on the street, or are they perhaps even taken to jail? And I argue that a lot of that can't really be understood without accounting for the horizontal relations between ambulance workers and their police and nurse counterparts. So that's the second part of the book, the sort of sorting of suffering bodies. And then the final part, to banish sort and hustle, is the hustle component. And I agree that ambulance crews hustle suffering bodies and that they do this through rapid intervention. So this is a sort of tricky argument because there's a significant literature out there that talks about how people are often waiting for services. And so I'm coming in from a labor standpoint and saying, well, from the standpoint of workers, there actually isn't much waiting from their point of view. What they're doing is often rushing people through interventions. And in my case, ambulance crews are rushing people through interventions because of the vertical pressures they face from managers who are often pressuring them to churn through as many billable transports as possible. And so my book tries to unpackage all of these various mechanisms by which ambulance crews help to govern suffering populations, and it's a suffering that tends to concentrate on the urban poor, by bandaging those bodies, sorting those bodies, and by hustling those bodies. And I argue that those are processes that are all interlinked, interlocked with one another via the labor process.
Right. You know, I think something that you mentioned that's interesting, right, is about the horizontal and the labor sort of like interconnected parts, right? And like how exactly the actors sort of work together. Something that's interesting is that, you know, I think especially when you look at a situation as critical as the life or death of scene, of course, it's important for like all of like the crew members to work together as a team, right? So do you feel that a lot of these vertical relations in that sense can maybe hinder the process of like working in like a team in that sense? Or like, does it help them? Or like how exactly, like does the dynamic work, if that makes sense?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that the vertical does a lot to sort of hinder or establish what is possible inside the ambulance. So, you know, there's often a frustration for ambulance crews, at least the crews that I studied, because they felt like they were encountering people who were summoning ambulance services for problems that they were in their view, in my view, they were right to think this, that they were sort of ill-equipped to handle. People were calling the ambulance because they, you know, basically because they're locked out of primary care, or because they want some housing for the night. They might want some food at the hospital for a night. And from the standpoint of ambulance crews, they are just not really equipped to even handle those problems very well. And much of that is vertically structured. It's structured by the protocols that the bureaucracy, the ambulance bureaucracy establishes. I mean, in terms of like when an ambulance crew is responding to somebody on the street who has, say, they call 911 because they feel like they need some housing, or they, you know, they want to get a meal for the night. At least the ambulance crew I studied in California, there isn't paperwork for them to even fill out to say, oh, we're taking this person to the hospital because they need food. That's not even an option. The menu of opportunities, the menu of interventions that ambulance crews are given are very medicalized, and they're very much oriented towards, you know, so-called real medical emergencies. But unfortunately, you know, or, you know, at least unfortunately from the standpoint of ambulance crews, most of the reasons people are summoning ambulances are sort of mismatched with what that menu of opportunities can provide. And I do think that this structures some, or helps explain and contextualize some of the tensions we see on the front lines between ambulance crews, nurses at hospitals, and police on the streets. So in my experience, I should say that in doing this research, I studied ambulance crews first, spent a year kind of shadowing them, observing them while they're working. And then in my second year of field work, I became an EMT myself and worked as an emergency medical technician, assisting the activities of better trained paramedics for about 9 months. It was about 3 months of training in addition to that. So it was about 2 years of field work overall. First year, kind of shadowing, watching people work. Second year, doing the actual work. And when I did the actual work, this became especially evident to me, that there's a lot of tension and struggle between ambulance workers and their nurse and police counterparts. So somebody would call an ambulance and, you know, they want to go to the hospital because they need, you know, in short, because they want housing for a night because it's bad weather, or because they want some food, or perhaps a prescription refill or something like that. Even if I, as an ambulance worker, am able to accept it and say, okay, this seems like a reasonable thing to do, I then have to confront the nurse, the triage nurse at the hospital, who more often than not would see that as an inappropriate reason to transport somebody. And so we often confront nurses at hospitals who were often dissatisfied with the cases that we would bring them. Now, sometimes they would, often they would realize, well, you know, sometimes our hands as EMTs and paramedics were tied, like we have to take somebody. If they demand that they go to the hospital, they have sort of entitled access that we have to take them. So nurses would understand that, but many of the nurses in the county I studied would often then question us, like, well, why did you take them to this particular hospital? Why not take them to a different hospital that's perhaps not as busy or something like that? And so there are a lot of tensions between ambulance crews and nurses with respect to the transport destination in which hospital you take them to. You'd often see this between ambulance crews and police on the streets, where police, you know, would often respond to somebody who is drunk or otherwise intoxicated, or perhaps are seen as a sort of public nuisance, or maybe having a psychiatric or a mental health crisis. And the police, for whatever reason, often actually do not want to arrest those people. Often it's burdensome to go through the arrest procedure. So what they'll try to do is sort of shuffle that burdensome case onto ambulance crews. And so they'll summon an ambulance crew to say, hey, take this drunk person to the hospital for the night. And ambulance crews often don't want to do that because they don't see that as consistent with their mission or their vocation to do paramedicine. They also know and can foresee that taking such a person to the hospital will present other conflicts potentially between nurses and ambulance crews. And so a lot of these conflicts, a sort of breakdown in a normal division of labor between these different emergency workers, be they nurses, ambulance workers, or police, can largely be explained, I argue, by these vertical structures, like how management, how bureaucracy and protocol writers structure what is even possible inside the ambulance or possible within any of these institutions. And so I don't, you know, want to put all the blame on managers or all the blame on those who are controlling and coordinating labor forces from above. But there is something to be said about the fact that forces from above, managerial forces from above, often structure and narrow what is possible within these institutions. And it can be inconsistent with the day-to-day grind of workers and the day-to-day problems and dilemmas that these workers face, and that can structure various tensions. Another example of this could be how managers with the company I work for. I work for a private 911 company. It's a private company that holds contracts with various local governments throughout the country to deliver ambulance services. And the company I worked with, you know, we would work 12 to 14 hour shifts. There was no guaranteed meal break. You know, it was often understaffed. We often felt we were overworked. And that produced a sense of exhaustion within us. And I argue could explain many of the tense interactions, including verbal and sometimes physical altercations between ambulance workers and their patients. And it's not to fully excuse workers for some of the things that I saw them do to patients, but you know, these are working people who were pushed often by management to work to extremes, and it exhausts them. You know, people working not only 12 to 14 hour shifts, but often without meal breaks, but often working 50, 60 hours a week. And much of that is explained or can be explained by the fact that they were underpaid. So they would often have to work so many hours to, you know, even make enough money to pay their rent and the high cost of living in California. So a lot of these vertical and the horizontal relations of this labor process that's explaining this bandaging and the sorting and the hustling of bodies, it's hard to even talk about them as being disconnected from one another. They are all kind of interconnected, but there is something to be said about the distinctiveness of the verticality and the horizontality and so on.
Definitely, right? And you know what, I think if somebody who's not studied it or somebody who's not gone into like the nuances that much, I think really sees the whole process of like going and picking up a patient and like taking them to the hospital as something pretty straightforward, right? You know, you have like an ambulance crew and you have a person. And you know, I think in that sense, like a lot of people don't really think about the role of the nurses and the police in that sense. So I just think I'd like a little bit more of like a detail into, you know, what the role of like the police is, especially, and like how exactly they have a role to play in terms of like the process that you've mentioned already.
Sure, yeah. So police and ambulance crews, they interact, you know, on a number of different types of cases. So I observed in my field work, I have field work, but I also have medical records. And what I found in my field work, or what I was logging and documenting in my notes, was consistent with what I was observing in these medical records, which is that about a fifth of ambulance calls in my study county involve interactions with law enforcement. So 20-21% involve interactions with law enforcement. You know, I should say I'd never had been in ambulance before I did this project. So I expected that ambulance crews and police would interact if I thought about it. I mean, I always kind of thought, well, yeah, I guess we'll see ambulance crews and police interacting on like gunshot calls or violence, perhaps on like motor vehicle collisions, because the police need to be there to sort of control traffic. And to be clear, they do interact on those things. Those are, you know, great predictors. If you're going to see ambulance crews and police together as a traffic collision or gunshot wound, you're almost guaranteed to see them in interaction. But they're just far more commonly interacting, in my case study, on these low priority calls. These calls that ambulance crews see as not legit calls, but what they often colloquially refer to as so-called bullshit calls. And that's in addition to being the most common type of call that ambulance crews respond to, sort of low severity, not much clinical intervention involved in them, just kind of a simple transfer to the hospital. That's just overall the calls that they're more likely to see. But it's also more common and more likely that they will see police on those types of calls. And that's because of the things I just mentioned, which is that the police are often summoning ambulance crews to handle somebody who was intoxicated or mentally disordered or disorganized temporarily, having a crisis, even if it's not seen as so-called legit police work, nor is it seen as legit you know, paramedical work. And those are the cases in which they were more frequently interacting on and more commonly interacting on were these low priority calls, which was a surprise to me, at least, because I thought that they were going to be like, you know, where the violence and the mayhem was. And certainly they are, but it's just more common on these low priority calls, which is why much of the relationship between ambulance crews and police, I don't want to say all of it, I don't even want to necessarily say most of it. I think most of the relations between that I observed between ambulance crews and police was one of general solidarity. They tended to see themselves more aligned and more friends than foes. And you could see this in particular as they would sort of kind of come together to complain about particular patients or complain about particular managerial forces that were somewhat common across their cases. I think they saw themselves more as fellow workers than they saw themselves as you know, distinct or conflicting workforces. But conflict was still relatively common. It wasn't, well, maybe that's not the right way to describe it, but it was still frequent enough that it was worth observing and examining in my study. And there's different types of conflict that can happen between ambulance crews and police. One is finger pointing, particularly if there was something that was, you know, a crisis, or say somebody dies on scene and somebody needs to be blamed. There would be, you know, sometimes some finger pointing, but that would usually happen on, you know, the more so-called legitimate types of calls, not the more mundane ones. And the conflicts over the more mundane, regular, you know, typical calls that ambulance crews are getting, these low severity calls, the typical conflict that I observed is what I refer to as burden shuffling. Like, how are you going to handle this burdensome case? Who's going to deal with this case that is, might be actually easier than the legitimate cases, but is vocationally not fulfilling? It's not consistent with one's professional mission. And that was, you know, a common struggle. Like, the cases that were seen as not medically legitimate were also cases that were often seen as not quote unquote real police work. And so these parties would sort of conflict over how they were going to handle these different cases. And the conflicts are often uneven. Police have more power than ambulance crews. So ambulance crews and police, say if they're struggling over what to do with a certain burdensome case, somebody who is intoxicated, kind of on the sidewalk, neither party really wants to deal with them. More often than not, the police will win out in those conflicts and those debates, because the police can draw a weapon that ambulance crews do not have, and that's the threat of incarceration. So it wouldn't be uncommon that ambulance crews and police would arrive on scene and there's somebody who's drunk on the sidewalk or something like that. And the police will say, well, I don't want to arrest this person. You should take them to the hospital. And so it's an interesting scenario where the police are not criminalizing somebody, but rather medicalizing them, because they don't want to deal with them. So if they can medicalize them, push them into a different professional jurisdiction, then they don't have to handle them. I thought that was very interesting. It was not what I expected going into the field. I read all this literature about criminalization and the penal state, and I thought, okay, the police are just out there constantly looking to criminalize people's problems. And they are in many ways, but here was a case in which the police were not criminalizing people's problems, were often trying to medicalize them so that they didn't have to handle them. And then we had, or I observed medical workers in response to this, not medicalizing the problems. They're trying to demedicalize it. And that was also scrambling my brain and wasn't making all that much sense to me, because I thought, well, medical professionals are supposed to be out there kind of medicalizing people's problems. That's what the literature on medicalization tells us. And instead, what we had were police trying to medicalize people's problems, and medical workers, ambulance crews, trying to demedicalize the problem. What the ambulance crews would often do is say, you know, so basically the police would be like, okay, this person should go to the hospital, they're sick, you know, and then the ambulance crew would say, well, you know, they'll run some quote unquote objective measures of their vital signs and say, well, look, their vital signs are within normal limits. They might ask the subject questions like, you know, do you feel okay? You know, are you alert and oriented to time, place, and event? You know, do you know who you are? Do you know where you are? And then they might ask them, well, do you want to go to the hospital? And, you know, if they say no, then the ambulance crew could basically be like, look, we're not in the game of kidnapping anybody. This person's alert and oriented. This person has no medical complaint. Their vital signs are within normal limits. So it's not a medical problem. Therefore, we don't take them. And then it's at that moment that police would often then draw that weapon that ambulance crews don't have, and that's a threat of incarceration. So they'll then say, okay, well, if you don't go to the ambulance with these people, then we're going to take you to jail for the night. And then at that point, the person will be like, okay, well, I want to go to the hospital. And so then that's an issue of entitled access, where ambulance crews can't deny taking somebody to the hospital once they say they want to go to the hospital and articulate a medical complaint. So then they'll say, okay, actually, I do have I'm not feeling well, so please take me to the hospital. So it's a weird interaction between ambulance crews and the police. It's an unequal struggle between them. Police have more power than ambulance crews because they have more coercive power. With that said, it's not just a space of like conflict and struggle between ambulance crews and the police. There's a fair amount of solidarity between them. But whether you're talking about solidarity or struggle between these workers, a lot of this amounts to what I call a sorting of suffering bodies. It is through these horizontal interactions between workers that that a decision is made regarding how somebody is going to be sorted, whether they're going to be sorted into a medical institution in the hospital, or they're going to be sorted into a penal institution like the jail or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, I wouldn't have imagined it to be this complex either. You know, I just thought that, you know, like someone would be sick and then they like send or call for an ambulance and go and pick them up. And I never really imagined, you know, this kind of dynamic. And I mean, it's also stressful, right, to think of the kind of stresses that, you know, ambulance crews face day after day, week after week, because, you know, it's such a high pressure job. And I feel like, you know, irrespective of the kind of practice that you have, you know, it is, you know, like very demanding, of course, you know, on so many levels. And I think along those lines, I just like to know a little bit about both the daily and the prolonged sort of stresses that ambulance crews face. And, you know, especially for those who've been on the job for so many years, right, what exactly, you know, are these stresses, and how exactly, you know, do they like take place or like materialize in that sense?
Yeah, I have a chapter in the book which is called Feeling the Ambulance, which is about the sort of emotional experiences of ambulance crews. And I talk about all these different sort of competing pressures that can exhaust crews, that can, you know, add significant stress to their life. And in short, it's quite a bit of stressors that are sort of workplace, rooted into the workplace. So I think the one that we probably usually think of when we're imagining the stressful life of ambulance crews is what I would call a sort of a grim stressor. Something about the grim nature of the work just has a significant impact on workers' subjectivities, their attitudes, their mental health, and so on. So to deal with somebody, you know, to have somebody die on your watch, to come across mutilated, grim, you know, quite honestly, disgusting scenes. All those things are true. They are incredibly stressful. You know, I know firsthand, I saw some terrible things that I wish I didn't see. And I know how that, you know, at least from my point of view, I know how those things can play a significant negative toll on your life. That said, those are still, by and large, a minority of the cases that ambulance crews experience. These so-called nightmare cases, where it's just so grotesque that it is sort of damaging in and of itself to just witness, let alone try to work on. Those calls happen, they're significant. We should pay attention to them. We should have, you know, infrastructure in place to help workers cope and handle those circumstances. But the fact remains that those are a relative, significant minority of the cases that ambulance crews in large urban areas within the United States are encountering. So maybe not a more significant stressor in terms of like on a case-by-case basis, but in terms of the large, as you say, a prolonged stressor, it's not so much the grim stressors that I'm concerned with, but rather the stressors that are linked to not a grim, but rather a grind. So the daily grind of constantly dealing with a sort of infinite wave of 911 callers while experiencing pressures from managers that tell you to sort of churn through as many billable transports as you can, produces a stress in and of itself by just simply exhausting you. And not only exhausting you, but exhausting you with cases that, for better or worse, ambulance crews see as not vocationally fulfilling, as they see as not really consistent with their mission, not necessarily consistent with what they signed up to do. So I think there's a number of responses to that kind of stress. You know, a number of kind of structural interventions we can imagine making to the ambulance. One approach, which I don't agree with, but one approach is to divert people away from the ambulance to say, okay, so some folks are just articulating problems that are mismatched with the ambulance. And the best way to handle that mismatch is to sort of divert them, teach them to not call 911, to have them deal with their problems elsewhere. I think that that's a really tall order in a society that has an incredibly thin social safety net and welfare services more generally. And so I'm not in the business, or I don't have the interest of denying people one of the few institutions in urban America that is promised to them. And the ambulance is promised to them. You know, you call 911 and you want an ambulance, more often than not, you'll get one. You have to wait a long time. And, you know, there's a number of problems with the system for sure. But it is an interesting case because it is a system that if you want it, you can get it. You might have to pay money for it and stuff, but if you want it, you can get it. So I don't want to divert people away from that. I would rather see interventions that transform the ambulance to better match the demands it experiences on the ground. And I think in doing that, while in addition to just getting more ambulances on the streets and therefore reducing the caseload that any crew faces, I think would do a better job of easing some of the stress that ambulance crews face. And one way you could do that is by, you know, making the ambulance better match problems it faces on the ground, making it not just a limited medical institution or just a limited emergency medical institution, but an institution that can connect people to various social services and a wider array of interventions beyond just emergency medicine. And I think that this would mean not only transforming the tools and the instruments that are inside of an ambulance, but also transforming ambulance education, the training for paramedics and the training for EMTs, and to get them, and there, to be clear, there are efforts to do this via so-called community paramedicine programs, but I think that there's still a ways to go. But I think if you can better match what ambulance crews are interested in and what they're capable of doing with the problems they confront on the ground, I think that will do a significant, make significant progress in alleviating the prolonged as well as the day-to-day stresses that they face.
Absolutely so. And, you know, I think as you mentioned, I think while, of course, on one hand, you do have the quantity of crew members and the number of ambulances that can go around, it is to an equal extent also about efficiency, right? And, you know, how best crew members can, you know, utilize and leverage their existing resources and how they can really make the best of that. And yeah, I think, you know, although I'd asked you earlier regarding the like the vertical and the horizontal structures that are there, which influence ambulance crew members and their functionings. I think along similar lines, I'd like a little bit more clarity on the capitalistic and the bureaucratic sort of structures that are also there on the top, you know, that really influence the functioning of these crew members on a more ground level, you know, like so to speak.
Yeah, so in making sense of my case and thinking about these vertical pressures that are imposing themselves atop the ambulance, controlling and coordinating ambulance crews, I study, again, a private company that holds a contract with the local government. And I argue that if you really want to understand the pressures that ambulance crews face from above, you have to account for a complicated nexus of managerial forces. That means a nexus of bureaucratic and capitalistic pressures. So this isn't a story, or my book is at least not a story about the hollowing out of the state, at least as we traditionally think of it. The state in my case remains present and powerful. So this local county bureaucracy, this EMS bureaucracy, doesn't deliver ambulances directly, but it writes protocols, it writes the contract that the ambulance company has to obey, it writes a fine structure, so we'll fine the company if it has late calls and a number of issues. So the state is present and powerful. And that's what I really am referring to with respect to bureaucratic forces. I'm really referring to public bureaucratic forces, public bureaucracy. And it's intertwined with this, with the capitalist interest of this private company who wants to make money off of delivering ambulances to people in the community. And it's a really complicated system, but when you're at ground level, it matters to understand those forces, because ambulance crews face sort of competing and contradictory pressures to do certain things. So the bureaucracy and the protocols that are written by the county government tells ambulance crews in my study that they have to respond to any and all calls. That's written in the protocols. Like if somebody calls 911 and they want to go to the hospital and they articulate a somewhat reasonable reason to go, and ambulance crews, and it's a very broad spectrum of what's considered reasonable. You just have to have sort of a medical complaint. So if you're saying something like my chest hurts, even if your EKG and all of these, you know, objective, so-called objective examinations suggest that that's perhaps not true, that there's not a real problem there. If somebody says that they, you know, have a, or if they articulate a medical problem and say they want to go to the hospital, you basically have to take them. That's written in the protocols. That's the bureaucracy that's really mandating that. So the bureaucratic pressures explain why ambulance crews and the policy written by the government explain why ambulance crews have to respond to anything and everything that's requested of them, by and large. But it's the capitalistic pressures of this private company that explains why they have to work so much of it so quickly. Because nowhere in the protocols does it suggest how many ambulances need to be on the streets. Nowhere in the protocols does it suggest how many cases an ambulance crew should respond to in a given shift. It just says that you need ambulance crews on the streets to respond to calls in a timely fashion. The private company finds ways to intensify the exploitation of ambulance crews within those larger structures. So their plan, from the standpoint of the, you know, the company, their plan to, their effort to make a profit is to have crews churn through as many billable transports as they possibly can. So if the bureaucracy helps explain the breadth of calls ambulance crews have to encounter and have to respond to, it is the capitalistic pressures that explain why they have to do it at a certain pace and why they have to do it so rapidly, hence this hustling component of the book. So both of those things are, you know, operating simultaneously. And I think both of them are important. You couldn't understand this just with the just from the standpoint of the capitalist interests of the company either, because the capitalist interests of the company doesn't explain why crews have to respond to anything and everything. If it was just the interest of the company and it was, you know, so-called naked self-interest of capitalism without the bureaucracy, what would happen is, you know, presumably these companies would only want to respond to people who have private insurance, or only want to respond to people who have cases that are going to be well reimbursed by their insurance. But that's not the case. The company has its sort of hands tied. They can't decide which calls they respond to, because the bureaucracy, the public agency has already established that whoever is servicing this contract must respond to anybody and everywhere. So it's this really complicated and often contradictory relationship between what I call public bureaucracy and private capital.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's definitely interesting. And, you know, I think I just like to shift gears a bit, right? Because, you know, I think in the book as well, you also mentioned how a lot of these hardships that patients face are actually unequally, you know, are like spread out and like distributed in that sense. So yeah, I just like to, you know, like hear a bit more as to, you know, like how a lot of like these structures that we have sort of influence that and why exactly these hardships are distributed in the ways that they are.
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, I frame the ambulance as an institution for governing urban suffering, which I think is a fair description of the ambulance, because as I said earlier, sort of the manifest, explicit, sort of taken for granted assumption about ambulances is that they treat and transport the critically ill and injured, regardless of where they're spread throughout the city. So it seems like it's a good institution for studying urban suffering and the management and the governance of that suffering. I probably should have started by clarifying what I mean by urban suffering and the governance of urban suffering. So I'm not suggesting that people who live in cities like live in absolute or permanent misery. They don't. In fact, there's a lot of research to suggest that people who live in cities actually tend to be happier and healthier than those who do not live in cities. But we've long known, since the writings of Frederick Engels, W.B. Du Bois, and others, that suffering in a multitude of forms, be it mental suffering, physical suffering, a generalized social suffering, all tends to concentrate towards the bottom of complex urban hierarchies that are often structured and polarized along lines of class and race. So I mentioned this in the introduction, there's this vast literature on sort of the social roots of sickness that links a number of different hardships that I encountered in the ambulance, that I encountered people experiencing, from gunshot wounds to various cardiac problems to respiratory problems and so on. There's a literature to connect basically all that, all those symptoms and all those diseases, all those illnesses and injuries. There's research that already exists out there that can link them to social conditions and social structures. There's this literature, the so-called social determinants of health literature, that suggests, you know, the sort of immediate or proximate conditions that people experience with respect to housing conditions, where they're positioned in the labor market, the kind of work conditions that they have, as well as the day-to-day stressors that they have, perhaps via neighborhood conditions, all those things, you know, in a multitude of ways, kind of multi-causal mechanisms concentrate sickness towards the bottom of social hierarchies. And I appreciate a lot of that literature. I think that probably more should be done to emphasize the larger structural forces that are shaping even those very forces that are accounted there. So, you know, talk about how one's work conditions makes, you know, produces certain risks for sickness, or certain housing conditions produce certain risks for illness or something like that. We need to also account for how larger structural forces of capitalism, racism, and so on are structuring housing conditions, are structuring employment conditions and work conditions that are in turn shaping risks within people's bodies and things like that. And so, you know, I'm really interested in how states and state delegated institutions manage and regulate and govern that downward distribution of suffering. And I think there's a multitude of institutions that manage those, that downward distribution of suffering. Some of them are welfare type interventions that aim to alleviate suffering. Some of them are punitive interventions that aim not to actually alleviate suffering, but actually to exacerbate suffering. And then I think there's medical institutions that are also there to alleviate suffering, but become intermixed and entangled with these larger forces of welfare provision, as well as punitive social control. And so I'm really interested, you know, much more broadly, you know, beyond the ambulance, I'm really interested in how state and state delegated institutions manage and regulate those populations that bear the brunt of suffering in the city.
Yeah, in fact, I think it reminds me of a lot of, you know, what sociology studies as well, right? Power dynamics and inequalities. And I think while, of course, inequalities are present throughout the globe, I think all the more so in the US, because especially where you don't have the safety net, especially if you look at healthcare, you know, I think it's all the more important. And and I think I just like to sort of wrap up with the final question. So as you already know, like, the social sciences as a field, right, is one where we are studying human beings. So of course, there are a lot of our own ideas and biases that sort of come in. So I just like to know if you have ever felt that your experiences or background or identity has ever influenced the course of your research, either in terms of your access to resources or your form of narration or any other factors that you might find, and what the implications of this might be.
Oh yeah, that's a heavy question, isn't it? What do you think about that? Yeah, so it's a kind of a question about how my social positioning might actually shape my research and the types of opportunities for research. Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I think that there were, in my ambulance study, there were things that sort of benefited me and also hindered me in terms of my various social positionings. So when I went in and did this ambulance research, because again, I take a labor-centric approach, so I'm studying workers, I'm studying paramedics and EMTs, and to be a paramedic and EMT in the United States does not require a bachelor's degree. You know, to be an EMT for me in the state of California, I became an EMT through a 6-week accelerated program, and that was it. And paramedics, you know, they only go through a couple of years of research. Granted, it's very intensive, or not a couple of years of training. I mean, it's intensive for sure, but it's not bachelor's level. So a lot of the folks that I encountered were not all of them, but a lot of them have not done a four-year college degree, were somewhat unfamiliar with university education, or had a sort of general understanding of it, but didn't necessarily know or fully understand what I was doing as a PhD candidate studying those spaces. I think there was a little bit of skepticism in terms of the types of things I was interested in. I think there was also a bit of confusion. I think some folks assumed I was like in a social work program. I think some folks thought I was actually, because I said I was a doctoral candidate, some folks thought I was like going to medical school. So it was a bit of clarification on what that meant. And I think that some folks, once they understood what sociology was and the standpoint of a sociologist, I think some of the people I was studying were a bit skeptical of me and thought that I was an apologist for the bad behaviors and the bad patients that call them, that, you know, they always, people were complaining that I would often offer sociological excuses for so-called 911 abusers and things like that. So there was, you know, coming from the university into, you know, I wasn't going into a hospital. I think it's different. You go into a hospital because a hospital, there often many of them are connected to universities. And so there's a sort of linkage between academia and medicine within hospital settings, not necessarily the case within ambulances. So it was a bit of a, you know, a disconnect there. But I did, you know, I think establish better connections with folks and perhaps I wouldn't have otherwise because of my background as a sort of working class person. You know, I was a high school dropout. I dropped out in the 10th grade and got a GED. There was no shortage of other folks who in my field site also had GEDs. I went to community college for 3 years before I transferred. A lot of these paramedic programs and even some of these EMT programs are in community colleges. So I had connections with those folks. You know, I'm also white male and have this working class background, which is very similar to a number of the paramedics and EMTs I worked with. And there was a bit of a disconnect between, you know, that it was like white male working class emphases within the workforce. And that was often mismatched with the Black and Latino patients that these crews were often encountering. And so I think that, strangely enough, I think that my social positioning, because it better matched the people that I was studying most closely, probably presented some unique opportunities. But again, it was a position that was kind of familiar, but also foreign to these folks that I was studying, because I might have had a somewhat similar background as many of them, as sort of working class and from, you know, a neighborhood that was not the neighborhood that they were most frequently working in. I also was, you know, an academic, and so I sort of separated myself from them in unique ways. And so I think it's, I think it's a really good question. I think it's one that's relatively complicated, I assume, for most people, because we come from a series of different social locations simultaneously. And I think that the trick is finding ways that, at least as an ethnographer, is finding ways that you are familiar and have sort of connections with folks, while also just acknowledging that you are foreign in many ways, that there's going to be some social positioning that is going to separate you from those that you study. And I think just being explicit and acknowledging those things can go a long way with folks. And I think, you know, having just honest conversations with the paramedics and EMTs I was studying about, you know, what a sociologist is, what a sociologist does, and how it was different, and how I did carry viewpoints that were different from how they were often talking about their patients and so on.
Very much so. In fact, you know, I think like a lot of times, right, like I feel like researchers and all that try looking at a lot of data and try to, you know, like situate ourselves from the outside, not really realizing that we are a part of these structures as well. And I feel like once you get that realization, you know, I think it, you know, like you begin to take perhaps a more humble sort of like outlook towards, you know, like your research. And I feel like a lot of this subjectivity, in fact, is really important in, you know, acknowledging like a lot of like the work and making it more authentic as well. So yeah, I appreciate the answer. And yeah, I think that's about it from my end. So thank you, Josh. It was a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. And sure. Congratulations on the success of your podcast. It's very cool.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, then please do subscribe or follow. You can also follow us on Twitter or Instagram at the handle DTRRH Podcast for further updates.